It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's no doubt that the internet has radically changed our world and the way that we live in it. It's been touted as the great social equalizer. It was supposed to provide a level playing field where everyone can participate and anyone can thrive.
But our next guest says we need to take a more critical look at who really benefits from our new digital culture. Astra Taylor is a Canadian-American documentary filmmaker, writer, and musician. Her new book is The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
Oh, thanks for joining. Thanks for having me.
Well, in the early days of the internet, there were some early adopters who had almost a utopian viewpoint. It was going to be a liberating force, democratizing. It was going to give us a lot of access and unleash a big creative force. You say it hasn't panned out that way, though. How has that changed? How has it really gone since the beginning of the internet?
Well, the story is more complicated, and all of us who use the internet every day, as most of us do, we know that. You know, we see that it's a space where you can have democratic participation, and you can also do your shopping, and you can also troll people or whatever. We know it's complicated, but there was this intense utopianism around it. But at the same time, there were also commenters who were convinced that everything was going to change for the worse. For everybody who said the internet would make us more connected, there was somebody who said it would make us more distracted. For everyone who said it would make us more intelligent and smart, there's someone who said it's, you know, destroying our ability to read. So the truth is somewhere in between. And I think what we haven't been paying enough attention to in the popular debate is the social and economic context that these technologies develop in. We really haven't been paying enough attention to the economic question, because so much of what shaped our old media landscape, the old media landscape that was supposed to be overthrown and revolutionized, were business incentives. So we had television that catered to advertisers, and that shaped the whole system, and social media platforms and all of these services we use every day are also beholden to advertisers. So that's one industry that hasn't been disrupted. If anything, it's spread and is more ubiquitous and omnipresent than it was under the old model. So, you know, the business imperatives are similar, and thus the technology is shaped in ways that make the new order look a lot like the old.
Well, one of the hopes was that, hey, this internet is going to clear away a lot of the old gatekeepers for creative people, for people who do independent journalism, who are people who are doing music, making documentaries. We'll get those gatekeepers out of the way and be able to reach the public directly. How has that played out?
Well, the gatekeepers are still there. They've just shape-shifted a bit. I mean, what's interesting is, first off, all the old media dinosaurs, as they were often called by technology pundits, they haven't gone extinct. They've actually adapted quite well. And so legacy media organizations are making record profits. But what we have alongside of the old like Hollywood tycoons, if you will, are these new Silicon Valley moguls. So we've got sort of the new and the old coexisting and sometimes collaborating and making deals with each other. So, you know, the old guard is still there. People are still watching TV. In fact, statistics show we're watching more television than ever. But then we're also using our Facebook, and we're searching for things on Google. And those mediators are really powerful. Google search algorithms can make or break a publication. You know, it has immense power because it's essentially an information monopoly. It's the search engine everybody knows and everybody uses. We don't even say we're searching something, right? We say we're Googling it. But of course, Google isn't, you know, a neutral forum to find information through. It has to rank things and it has to make a profit. And so it privileges some information over others. And the values that are woven into its code are not neutral. And those are the things we have to be like more critical and aware of. And I think they're really crucial for media literacy for the generation that's coming up.
How has all of this affected the creatives, musicians like you, people writing? We see a lot of people putting a lot of music and a lot of fiction and a lot of other creative output onto the internet. Isn't that a good thing?
Definitely. It's definitely a good thing. And I think that we can celebrate people communicating and sharing and creating. But the credit goes to the human beings who are creating things and not necessarily the companies that they're interfacing with. I mean, if I had a meaningful conversation with you over the telephone 20 years ago, we'd give credit to ourselves and not the telephone. So I think the humans deserve the credit. But there are ways in which the barriers or the obstacles that people face are a little less visible than they used to be. It used to be really obvious. You could look at the masthead of a magazine and go, okay, those are the editors. Those are the gatekeepers. Now it's not so clear. But increasingly, you know, the most popular video makers on YouTube, people who have sometimes millions of subscribers to their YouTube channel, are actually being managed by talent companies, working closely with advertisers and creating sponsored content. In some cases, those talent companies and production companies are actually owned by traditional Hollywood media companies. It's just not on the surface. It's hidden. It's kind of invisibilized, if you will. And so what happens is money and connections and celebrity and being sensational are just as crucial to this new order as they were. But there's this myth that it's a meritocracy and that the best will just rise to the surface. So I think we need to ask ourselves why, if that's the case, you know, are the same old superstars still superstars, and challenge this idea that we have a level playing field.
Well, one of the solutions you suggest, being in public broadcasting, was interesting. You're proposing, if I'm reading it right, something like a public internet media entity. What would that look like?
Yeah, there's this idea that because we don't have spectrum scarcity, that we don't need public media. So spectrum scarcity is the idea that, you know, when you had a television, there was a limited spectrum, so there were limited channels, and we had a sort of imperative to carve off a few of those and create a space for educational or alternative non-commercial programming. But of course, that wasn't just given over to people without a fight. It was something that we to organize for and advocate for and make arguments for. And sort of what happened was the advertising supported television and the soap operas that sold soap and the quiz shows that were rigged just got too much. It was too much to bear. People wanted a line between editorial content and advertising, and they fought. The idea now is that there's infinite, you know, hypothetically infinite space on the internet, so we don't need an option like that. And I disagree. I think that we're actually in a kind of similar situation where there's more and more sponsored content. It's unclear whether the people speaking are actually being paid, whose interests they're serving. And we talk about things like Facebook and Twitter like their town squares, like their public spaces, when in fact they're more like shopping malls because they are driven by advertising and which is about selling us stuff. And I think we actually should put our heads together and think of a public option. And that doesn't mean that it's the only business model that should exist, but I think it would be good to supplement what's out there with something else. And we've had a similar change of course in the past. So I'm talking about a space that is has a different business model that wouldn't ultimately be in the business of surveillance, which is what advertising online is, because online the ads and marketers track you. It's not like the old days where you just watched the ad and turned it off. And thinking about funding things through some sort of subsidy or tax revenue. And, you know, this happens in lots of realms of life. So it's not so far-fetched.
People have said, well, why a top-down thing when you've got bottom-up collaborations, something like Wikipedia? Why don't we see more things along that kind of model?
That's a really good question. Why don't we see more things along that kind of model? Because it's held up as the paragon of a new participatory democratic digital model. And there are many, many books and articles that hail Wikipedia as sort of what we should be, how we should actually imagine the new digital world. And actually what's striking is that there's only one Wikipedia. There, of all of the top sites we use, and this is backed up by ComScore data, you know, it's the only non-commercial site that's in the top 50. You know, otherwise we go to commercial sites. So it's very rare, and in that sense it's precious. And part of that is that, you know, it is very difficult to fund a site like Wikipedia. They often have to, you know, struggle through their funding drives, and scramble for support. And we don't have sort of social mechanisms to create more spaces like that. So I think, you know, Wikipedia gets a lot of attention, but I think we should recognize how unique it is.
You titled your book, The People's Platform. What are you hoping people do, individual internet users, to change things?
Well, I think the first step is understanding and analyzing things. I think right now we're at a really interesting moment where there's a kind of inchoate sense that things have gone awry, and a lot of that has to do with the NSA revelations, and, you know, there's a sense that we're all addicted to our phones, and it's not making us feel good, or this or that, and I kind of want people to step back and look at those emotions, and look at those feelings of skepticism, and take it to the next level and ask why it is that all of the good things we were promised and that we hope for haven't come to pass. And I think it has to do with the fact that the internet is born of the real world, and it can't escape some of the structural conditions, the fact that, you know, the rich get richer, and that, you know, you have to adhere to the bottom line. And so you have to look at it in that context, in the actual real world. And then you can think about realistic ways of making it better. So I think people have to think critically and then start organizing and aggregating their voices to demand something else.
Astra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
That was Astra Taylor, Canadian-American documentary filmmaker. Her new book is The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age.